This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Father Ian visited schools in San Luis Obispo County to get firsthand insight into the benefits of the California Wheat Commission's Wheat to School program.
All the children who have access to the exact same food, and they can actually have it at least two times per day.
Then KCBX reporter Alyssa Toledo brings us a story about the musical Million Dollar Quartet that recreates a historic night that got legends Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Elvis Presley, and Johnny Cash jamming together.
This is more of a complex and a character-driven version of Million Dollar Quartet.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 24th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with an interview with KCBX reporter Amanda Wernick, who has been covering the restarting of the Refugio pipeline by Sable Offshore Corporation. The Santa Barbara Board of Supervisors have scheduled to hear appeals from the public at 9 a.m. on February 25th at the County Administration Building. My interview with Amanda is from before this hearing date was set. Hello. In 2015, 120,000 gallons of oil spilled and entered the ocean near the Refugio State Beach that caused widespread damage, particularly to wildlife, including birds and marine mammals, according to the California State Lands Commission. The Refugio oil spill is considered one of the worst ones in U.S. history. Plains All American, the company that owned the pipeline, had to pay $60 million in damages and cleanup costs. In February last year, a new company, Sable Offshore Corporation, bought the Santa Ynez unit, which includes the damaged pipeline. Here with me today is KCBX reporter Amanda Wernick, who has been reporting on this issue. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, Meher. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us and helping to shed light on this developing story. Could you tell us what is currently happening with the pipeline?
So what's currently happening is the new owners, Sable, are trying to reopen this pipeline. So it's been pretty much it's been closed since the spill, and now they're trying to reopen it. So last year, the county approved the transfer of the permit from the old owners, Plains All American, to Sable. And local environmental organizations are really pushing back against this decision. So they filed an appeal against this transfer of permit. The hearing is expected to happen this year. But basically, these nonprofits are pushing back because they believe the risks of another catastrophic accident happening are just too great. And they don't think Sable has been or, you know, will be capable of doing everything possible to prevent another accident. So these groups are fighting to hold Sable accountable and just make sure they don't, you know, take any loopholes or skip any steps because of the potential consequences of reopening this pipeline.
Can you talk to us a little bit about these environmental groups, who they are, and is there anything specific or one or two of their major concerns that they especially are talking about?
Yes. So the local environmental groups include the Environmental Defense Center. So they're based in Santa Barbara, and their main concerns are that Sable is not following all the safety regulations necessary to make sure such an accident doesn't happen again. They really want Sable to do everything possible to, you know, be transparent to the public as well and prevent corrosion and things like that. So the Environmental Defense Group pushed Sable to release more information about possible corrosion and just other safety conditions of the pipeline. And in response, Sable filed a restraining order against the state to prevent having to release this information. So these groups are mainly concerned about just holding Sable accountable and transparency. And, you know, Sable has told KCBX they're following all the rules and, you know, they're being 100% honest and transparent when the environmental groups are pointing out, you know, some of Sable's actions show otherwise. You know, October of last year, Sable did unauthorized construction on the pipeline. It wasn't legally permitted, and they still did it. So for this reason, it's important for me to keep covering this topic and reporting on it, because oil companies such as Sable need to be accountable and transparent, especially when it comes to operating the pipeline responsible for one of the worst oil spills in history. So, you know, I'll continue to report on this topic as new developments emerge.
How did you come to report on this story, and how long have you been reporting on it?
I'd say I've been reporting on it for about a year. So the first story I did was Plains All American, the former owners of the pipeline, having to pay a settlement to property owners. So that happened last year. And then a lot of new things have been happening with the new owners as they're really ramping up their efforts to get this pipeline going. And the state recently approved a waiver that was a huge hurdle in this process. So that moves Sable even closer to getting this pipeline operating. And it's an ongoing conflict of local environmental groups such as the Environmental Defense Center and Center for Biological Diversity really pushing back against this and saying, you know, it's not a good idea. And they're going to do everything they can to either prevent it from happening or just make sure Sable does everything necessary to prevent such a catastrophe from happening again.
So amidst all this, what has been the response from the community in Santa Barbara?
I think that the community was devastated by the oil spill. It affected various species. It shut down fisheries. It closed down multiple beaches. So a lot of residents just are very concerned about something like this happening again. And that's why they want to hear the full story from Sable. And just that's why transparency to the public is so important, because operating this pipeline, while it could be profitable for the owners, what could have long-lasting impacts on the community as the accident in the past had.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali talking to Amanda Wernick about Sable Offshore Corporation and its plans to restart the Refugio pipeline. You mentioned that Sable had been doing unauthorized construction on the pipeline last year, and that was reported. What were the consequences? Were there any consequences?
So they did this around October of last year, and there weren't any consequences, but it was more so that they violated the law in doing construction. And, you know, following regulations closely is a really important part of preventing another oil spill from occurring. And the fact that they tried to circumvent that really was alarming, I think.
The other thing that you mentioned, which also kind of reflects on their approach to this, is that they tried to block the report that was going to come out about the condition of the pipeline. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Right. So Sable filed a restraining order, and they said this was to prevent the state from releasing an unredacted document detailing pipeline safety conditions and spill risks. So, you know, this document was available, but they had certain sections crossed out. And so the Environmental Defense Center filed to get them to release these, and the restraining order was a way for them to keep those private. So Sable told KCBX that, you know, releasing this confidential information could expose the pipeline to sabotage. So that was their argument, while the environmental nonprofits were saying, well, the public has an urgent need to know, you know, just full transparency about the conditions of this pipeline, and that should be prioritized above all.
And is that report now public?
No, it's not.
Oh.
So the restraining order blocked that from being released.
And the restraining order can't be challenged in any way?
I don't believe it's been challenged.
Does the county need people to vote before it permits Sable to restart the pipeline, or is it already been greenlit?
So the county already voted to approve the transfer of this permit. So the Environmental Defense Center filing an appeal, this would set another hearing and give them the chance to reconsider that decision.
the process was that the county voted on it, and so the permit is now transferred to Sable Offshore, which gives them the right to move forward with restarting the pipeline.
Exactly.
And then the nonprofit that challenged that, basically that puts a wrench a little bit in Sable Offshore restarting the pipeline?
It could potentially.
How so?
Depending on how the hearing goes, this would require them to revisit it.
Living on the Central Coast, why should people care about this issue?
I think people should care about this issue because the Central Coast is one of the most biologically rich areas in the world. Environmental groups and legislators have been fighting to protect the waters here and keep the ecosystem safe. And oil and drilling is, in my opinion, not the best thing for the environment. And we should be looking towards renewable energy. But, you know, as a journalist, it's my job to give both sides of the issue the chance to voice their perspective. So every time we report on these stories, we do reach out to Sable and we care a lot about hearing both sides. You know, the Central Coast environment is precious and important to protect. So I think I am a strong proponent of making sure Sable follows all the rules they're supposed to. And if this pipeline does come online, that it's looked at and monitored to prevent a terrible oil spill from happening again.
So when you do approach Sable, generally what has been their response? Has it been just one response or has it changed over the course of you reporting on this issue?
Their responses have remained pretty steady, just saying that they're following all the right regulations, and I can pull up a quote from them.
Yeah.
So Sable said that they told KCBX they believe they're going above and beyond the state and federal requirements. So they've really held their ground that they're doing everything they're supposed to do, and that's that.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I think we've just about covered it.
Okay. Thank you, Amanda, for your time and for explaining this important issue to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Meher.
That was KCBX reporter Amanda Wernick. A public hearing on restarting the Refugio oil pipeline is taking place in Santa Barbara at the County Administration Building at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, February 25th. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Up next, Father Ian's Playing with Food.
And this is part of our Farm to School Incubator Grant. Our sixth grade agriculture students learn the entire life cycle of a wheat crop. And so they actually plant it and then we do a large whole school harvest.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. That's me with Lauren Thomas, Food Services Director at San Miguel School District. She's showing me the wheat field at Lillian Larson Elementary School. It's fascinating. As part of Lauren's commitment to get kids eating locally produced food, learning where their food comes from, and ultimately eating healthier, the Wheat to School program provides hands-on opportunities for kids to do all of that.
This is the same varieties of wheat that we purchase from another local farmer up north, John Eck, Sonora, and Simpatwin. And then that goes out to Shandon, and she has that large mill. And mills it into flour, and then we're able to bake products for the kids with that.
How many pounds of wheat do you get?
Off of this crop, probably 100. And so it's not enough to feed all the kids with, but it's enough for educational demonstrations and little mock mills. It's already started to head, and so as long as it doesn't continue to rain, we should have a good crop to harvest at the end of May.
Wow, I accidentally grew wheat in my backyard last year.
Accidentally? Do you know what variety it was?
I have no idea. It was not as robust as this. It did not fruit as much as this.
We have a farmer friend, Larry, who will come out and bring a thresher. So the kids will come in with some scissors and cut all the wheat heads. And then they bring it to him in a thresher, and that threshes the husky part off. And then you're left with just the kernels.
I did all that by hand.
Mm-hmm.
I visited at harvest time, and the kids had a presentation for me before I joined the harvest.
I'm Christina Wilkinson, and I'm a second grade teacher and an ag enrichment teacher at Lillian Larson School. And my students are sixth grade agriculture enrichment students, and they've been learning about wheat all year long, and they've planted it, taken care of it, and now we're harvesting it today. They are going to give you their wheat presentation.
I will now be talking about wheat's history. In 1800s, wheat was produced to feed miners during the gold rush. 1850, wheat was produced higher than any local consumption of grain. It was first exported overseas to European markets, then was used to feed soldiers fighting on both sides of the Civil War. 1920, wheat lessened the fertility and health of soil. 1920, farmers couldn't make any money growing wheat. 1936, wheat hadn't made good money for the farmers and was grown as a monocrop. Today, different types of wheat are grown on a much smaller scale.
Thank you for listening to our presentation.
Thank you for giving your presentation.
As I watched the kids harvest their small strip of wheat, I spoke with the Cal Poly professor and Larry the farmer.
My name is Nick Williams, and I'm a professor at Cal Poly in environmental management.
How are you involved in this wheat growing project?
I have that other plot in the back as an experimental plot where we're growing some varieties of wheat, and we have a paired plot on the Cal Poly campus where we're growing the same varieties. And so it's a comparison of the sort of performance of the grain in each of the different locations.
Is the school involved in harvesting your wheat as well?
No, I have students that will come and harvest the wheat from Cal Poly, but the idea in the long term is to be able to use sort of a similar experimental design at the different schools in this area as well as at Cal Poly to be able to broaden our sort of knowledge of the environmental factors and how they affect wheat production.
What do you think is the most important thing for the kids to learn through this project?
The way that we've set up our plot, the idea is to be able to expose people to the idea of agricultural biodiversity and the importance of having different grains, different varieties growing in the same place at the same time to be able to adapt to the environmental conditions and respond to the variability that inherently is part of farming.
Through your work at the university, what are you hoping that the general public will learn through your work?
It's less about the general public learning than it is about trying to help local farmers or future farmers be able to gain knowledge about how they might be able to effectively grow wheat in different parts of the county when a lot of the sort of traditional knowledge of wheat production has been lost because people don't grow that much wheat here anymore, whereas historically they did. There used to be a lot of wheat production in this county. People have moved on to specialty crops that are a lot more resource intensive because you can make a lot more money growing it. But thinking into the future of there is a higher potential for a market for sort of boutique wheat because there's whole grain bakeries that are trying to produce novel products that people didn't really buy before, and especially for the price that they're willing to pay now. And so wheat is a more viable crop than I think it was in the past. And so the idea is how do we identify the best varieties to grow and also different techniques of being able to grow in sustainable ways to be able to help sort of the future of farming in this area.
Yeah, I'm Larry Hun, and I'm a farmer that owns and operates a family farm near the town of Clarksburg, which is just south of Sacramento.
What are you doing here at Lillian Larson Elementary School?
I'm an active member on the California Wheat Commission. We have a program here that we're teaching these kids about wheat. I'm here to manage the harvester.
Do we have a giant wheat field and a giant harvester? My stepfather grew wheat in Nebraska, so these kids couldn't drive a harvester.
No, the kids can cut the heads off. They got a pair of scissors, and then they bring those heads to me, and then I hand feed them into the machine. Well, the machine is just like a regular combine. It has a cylinder, and then we have air, a fan that blows air to separate the chaff from the seed, and then you have a screen that sifts out the seed from the chaff, which is exactly what a regular combine does, the same thing, just on a very small scale. It weighs about 250 pounds.
It's about half the size of a desk that would go in an office, right?
Correct.
What are you hoping the kids learn?
Most kids don't even understand where their food comes from, and hopefully here they'll see what wheat looks like when it's in the head and watch it grow throughout the season, and then mill it and then have the seed come out of the head, and then actually we have a table where they're grinding it and making it into flour, and then we have our kitchen over here where we're making pizza. They can see the whole system and understand how it all functions, because I think a lot of kids, they think that most foods come just from the store.
They need a cow and some cheese making and some tomatoes as well to like full circle the pizza.
Absolutely. Yeah, right.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm harvesting wheat at Lillian Larson Elementary School in San Miguel, where young wheat farmers are harvesting wheat by hand. The next steps are threshing, milling, and baking.
We get to see threshing. Yay, exciting!
Okay, come on up here. Come on up here. Go collect the wheat from the...
Put them all in one bucket.
One bucket. The students just hand-harvested wheat. Now they're coming over to the thresher, and they're going to see how we thresh the wheat. Take the stalk away from the wheat berries. So go ahead and take a wheat berry, just one, and taste it. Mmm, how crunchy. So this is the wheat berries that we just pulled out that just separated from the shaft. Now we're going to go over, you guys are going to go over and see how it's milled.
So we're putting the wheat kernels into the mill and it'll come out through a small tunnel and turn into flour. Turn it on.
Wheat kernel has passed through. The wheat kernel is passed through a machine to separate the grains from the outside grain. The wheat is ground into fine powder. The powder is sifted into making a very fine flour.
Before we find out what the kids do with the wheat, let's chat with two people who are fully immersed in the Wheat to School program. First, let's go into the school and see how the wheat is used.
I'm Jalene Coelho. I am the food service director for Shandon Joint Unified School District. We are looking at my mill. It's a 36-inch stone mill.
It looks very modern. I was thinking like this ancient stone mill that you unearthed from one of the Chumash tribes or something like that. So.
Now, if you want to see that, go out to Mission San Antone and you can see an old mill. We don't do enough to mill. We do just little garden plots as a learning thing for now. Eventually, I would like to do acres of wheat and would be an FFA project for some kids. For our school, this is a grant project that we did. We are, as far as we know, the first school in California, if not in the United States, to have a stone mill in their kitchen. It was brought to our attention by Claudia Carter of the California Wheat Commission. She got us involved in this and we just said, yeah, we'll try it and went running with it. It's fun. So I mill for our pizza dough, muffins. I also mill for San Miguel School District. We kind of collaborate on all this wheat to school, farm to school stuff.
Does milling your own flour create more work for you?
Well, of course, but that's okay. That's totally okay. It's worth it. I am a huge proponent of kids knowing where their food comes from. I strongly believe that all kids should know that their food is grown by farmers and ranchers, and it doesn't come from the grocery store. It actually comes from someone's hard work.
So do you want to show me how it works?
I can. What I first do is I have a hopper that the grain goes in. This is about 20 pounds of Patwin that we're going to mill today. And I put it in the hopper and I set the stones to where I want them. It gets pretty noisy. Yeah,
Let's do it.
Okay. That's probably about 20 to 25 pounds of grain seeds, or they call them berries. What I do is I first turn my mill on. It's gonna squeak and whirl, and I let it warm up for a little bit.
And so what's happening inside? We can see the stone right here, right?
Yep, that's the bottom stone. That's stationary. The okay. top stone is what does the movement.
But we can't see it.
You can't not see okay. it, no.
But the concept is exactly like a mill thousands of years ago.
Absolutely.
The two stones rubbing
Absolutely.
Together.
Yep, it sure is. I actually did a vacation to Tennessee and we went up to the Great Smoky Mountains and they have mills all up there that you can still see and they were from 150, 200 years ago. It's really cool. I took a lot of pictures of it because I was so excited to see them and theirs were mostly for corn, but it's still the same. I mean, the patterns are very similar on the stones that they were from hundreds of years ago that they still use today. This raises and lowers my stone. It's a gear-driven mechanism here, and I'm going to lower it until I hear the stones just whispering to each other. You'll hear what I mean. So basically I'm tightening the stones together to melt so it will make the finest flour I can. It's gonna get really loud now.
That was really cool.
When you mill your own, you get everything in it. It's not taken apart and put back together like all-purpose is. All-purpose doesn't have all the components of a wheat berry anymore. That's the difference. Harder to work with.
Where do you get your wheat?
All of our wheat is grown in the state of California. That's how it's considered local. Most of our wheat comes from the Sacramento area because that's where they grow it.
How much is delivered? How often?
We get a ton at a time, so 2,000 pounds at a time.
Where do you store a ton of wheat?
Right now I have about 6 tons of wheat. I have a refrigerated insulated sea train that keeps it temperature controlled, so it will last for a really long time.
How much do you go through in a school year?
Depending on what we do with it, we could go through about 2 tons a year.
So you have more than one kind of wheat?
We do. We do Patlin, we do Hard Red, we do Durham, and then we do Sonora, which is the local Indians grew at Mission San Miguel.
Okay.
So it's a historical thing for us also, but it's also one of my favorites. It's great in muffins. I always put a little bit of it in almost everything I bake because I just love the flavor profile of it.
So you seem to know a lot about the different flours produced by the different wheat and how to use them in different things. Is that something that you knew before this project, or have you been learning it along the way?
I did not know anything about milling or anything about the different wheats. It's been a great learning experience. I've learned so much from Claudia and her team at the California Wheat Commission. We go up there for classes and they teach us how to do all of our baking with our whole grains, and they've developed some really neat recipes for us. I'm looking at growing this program into the high school. They get to enjoy all the products though. Everything we make goes to everybody throughout the district.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I was just at Shandon Elementary School to see their impressive stone mill that makes flour for both Shandon and San Miguel schools. I kept hearing Claudia's name, so I got onto Zoom with the person who oversees the Wheat to School program on the state level.
I am Claudia Cotter. I work at the California Wheat Commission. I'm the executive director. I work for California Wheat Producers.
How did the school thing develop?
Back in 2018, a person named Allison Bright Rose came knocking on our door here in our office saying, "Hey, you're the Wheat Commission, and we're growing wheat in our school garden here at Dingo Elementary with our volunteer Chuck. He knows how to grow it, and he's growing it, and it's almost ready to be harvested, or will be, but we don't know what to do afterwards. So tell me what you do and tell me how you can help." So I was like, "Oh my gosh, that's so exciting. That sounds so much fun." So I went to see the field, that the mini plot that they had at Dingo Elementary, and I was so excited. I also participated in different activities with children, and I saw how exciting it was for them to be outside looking at the field, helping. So then I say, why don't we do what we do at the lab? We brought the kids, we brought their wheat, and we showed them how we mill it, how we process it into pasta. We extruded pasta with them, tortillas, a cookie. Then they were just super, super exciting to be here and seeing the whole process from the beginning to the end. They were able to take flour with them. They were able to take some of the pasta with them. So that's how things started with the school collaboration programs. And later on in 2021, I applied for the California Department of Food and Agriculture Farm to School grant. I pitched in the idea that we could bring this education program to other schools. We did get the grant, and we were able to establish this similar program, not the same, with a lot more complicated factors at the two school districts that we partnered at that time with, Shandon and San Miguel. They saw the faces and the exciting part that the kids and the things that they were experiencing on the ground when we were planting it. But they also figured out how fun and exciting it will be for them to use this flour that they were milling into a product. But the biggest thing that I realized that was the turning point for the food service directors, Jillian and Lauren, was when they started experimenting and trying with these flours, and they tasted it and figured out how much better they tasted. Also, how well, in general, most of the products they made for the kids were received. Being skeptical which is typical about whole grains that are not very good, that they don't taste well, the texture is bad. Their excitement, they're all of like, oh, wow, this is incredible. It's, I think, what brought them to say, okay, let's keep this program going.
What is the ultimate goal for this Wheat to School program for you?
I believe that we should give the chance for children to eat more fresh, in this case, freshly made whole grains, and that they should be given that opportunity by helping the school districts to have more scratch baking. Some people say that nutrition education is not worth it because it doesn't translate. It doesn't go to the family. The parents make the decisions. They buy the food for the kids. So it doesn't have an impact. I think that's not completely right because I still remember being little, tasting the delicious grandma food that I still want to eat today, or eating a fresh tomato in Ecuador that is very different than in the US. I still crave that. So when we are exposed to these, I think they create these core memories that remind us of something that is really, really good. You remember later on in life and you want to go back for that. There's not that much availability of whole grains out in the market. If they are, they're not so great tasting. We understand that. Their price point tends to be higher. So all these things where we can bring the best food with food justice in mind is actually schools, because the schools are part of this program through the government. All the children will have access to the exact same food, and they can actually have it at least 2 times per day.
Back to San Miguel. They have harvested, threshed, and milled their wheat, and now they are baking tasty stuff right next to the field.
This is cinnamon bread that they made.
With whole wheat. Whole wheat.
They just made it today?
Just made it now.
And then here, you can have a piece.
Still warm.
We have our uni oven set up here, and we have some 100% whole wheat pizza dough that we do a little bit of a cinnamon sugar bread to do a taste so that the kids see the entire life cycle of the wheat.
Have I seen the entire life cycle? I saw them picking, and then we did the threshing, and then we did the milling, and now we have the pizza. Is that everything?
Yeah, we planted the wheat, then they harvested it. We put it through the thresher, then you have the grain, then it gets milled, and then the flour gets turned into pizza dough with a little bit of water, salt, and yeast.
The flour to make this pizza dough, did that come from the field today? Is that the stuff that they picked today?
No, we can't grow enough wheat for what we need for school meals. So the flour was milled out Shandon, and we got that from a local grain farmer in the valley.
Okay, so where will this wheat go?
The wheat here we use mostly for education purposes to show the kids the life cycle through the mill, and then a lot of it gets replanted in the fall, and we'll just put it back into the field.
While we're on the subject of students baking with whole grain wheat that is locally sourced, I want to pop back to Claudia, who has the perfect sign of the program's success.
Woodland Unified School District, specifically Dingo Elementary, 80% or more students are Mexican-American. Their staple food are probably rice, tortillas, beans. Since 2018, we have been making the tortillas for the students, with the students, with the wheat that they grew, they mill. And we make it into 100% whole wheat tortilla. 90%, if not more, of every single class that we have had here, we have the students saying this is the best tortilla ever had. It is not a perfect tortilla. It is kind of dry. It is kind of winky and weird because they make it their own. So it's going to have some edges here or there. It's a little thick sometimes. But they still love it and they still like it. Of course, there's some that are going to say, yeah, it's okay. But in every single class, we have students saying, can I have a second one? This is better than my grandma's tortilla, or this is better than my mom's tortilla.
Ooh, yeah. Those are some serious words.
I know. That's in almost every single class we have had here.
If that's not a rousing endorsement for the Wheat to School program, nothing else is. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Next, a story from KCBX reporter Alyssa Toledo about Million Dollar Quartet, a musical that is currently playing at the San Luis Obispo Repertory Theater until March 9th.
Just a little talk with Jesus. Remember that?
On December 4th, 1956, four icons, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins, gathered at Sun Studios in Memphis for an impromptu jam session. The moment was legendary, capturing the collision of talent and raw energy that shaped the future of American music. Million Dollar Quartet brings that night to life, not just through music, but through the relationships and tensions that define the artists' careers. Toby Tropper, a Central Coast-based actor, plays Sam Phillips, the visionary producer behind Sun Records, who discovered each of these musicians and helped launch their careers. He says the show offers more than just a jukebox musical. It's a look at a turning point in music history.
This is more of a complex and character-driven version of Million Dollar Quartet with amazing, incredible music by really, really talented performers. I mean, you know, I get to basically just watch a concert, yeah, all the time. Million Dollar Quartet is about the legendary historic night in December of 1956 when at Sun Studios in Memphis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Elvis Presley, and Johnny Cash all were in the same place at the same time and had a jam session. And they were all discovered by one man, who is my character, Sam Phillips, who is the founder of Sun Studios, the record producer, and the father figure for them all.
The production doesn't just tell a story. It immerses audiences in it. Unlike larger venues where performances can feel distant, Slow Rep's intimate space brings the audience directly into the studio, making them feel like a part of the recording session. Zachary Tate, originally from Savannah, Georgia, is performing as Johnny Cash for the seventh time in his career.
I hear the train a-comin', it's rolling around the bend, but I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when.
Personally, this is one of my favorite theaters that I've worked at for this show, particularly just because of the intimacy of the space. At no point, you know, in the audience is an audience member more than maybe 15 feet away from the cast. And I think for a show like this, where it all takes place in the recording studio, I think that, you know, allows the audience to sit in as if they're really sitting in on the recording session.
The show's cast acts and also plays their instruments live, creating an authentic sound true to the era. Tony Costa, who plays Elvis Presley, had to shift his approach from the well-known Vegas-era Elvis to a younger, more unpolished version of the icon. Costa has played Elvis in multiple productions, but this is his first time in Million Dollar Quartet.
Here the Lord comes and calls me away.
I haven't played young Elvis since I was like 25. So it's going back to a little bit higher of a voice, a little bit, it's basically don't listen to the Las Vegas years, listen to those first albums over and over again.
And the night is as black.
While the music is at the heart of the show, the production also explores the broader cultural shifts happening in the 1950s.
People really love it, you know, and they've been saying that it's a deeper version that they are used to. And a lot of people have been following the narrative and the story more, which is great.
With high energy performances and a story that goes beyond the music, Million Dollar Quartet has captivated audiences throughout its run at Slow Rep, already selling out multiple performances. The production wraps on March 9th, and for KCBX News, I'm Alyssa Toledo.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Meher Ali. Next, my interview with Carolyn Kruger and David Yeo, who, along with other SLO community members, are organizing a poetry reading at 7 p.m. this Wednesday, February 26th, to honor the life and work of Rifat Al-Arir, a Palestinian writer, poet, professor, and activist.
Welcome, Carolyn and David.
Thank you.
So,
The title of your event is Let It Be a Tale, Words of Resistance, Words of Love. What does it mean? And why did you feel there was a need for such an event? Carolyn, let's start with you.
The title refers to the fact that Rafat himself considered poetry writing an act of resistance. Mm. And words of love, because his words were written with love, and we want to inspire love when we think of Gaza. Mm. The idea actually came from David Yeo and Dolores Howard, one of our team members who couldn't be here. And we added another member, Hilal Jarar, a Palestinian from SLO, mm-hmm. and decided to put the event together to start stressing culture, Palestinian culture, and Palestinians as full human beings, not just victims in Gaza. And also, we think the words of their poets will convey the experience of being Palestinian, which is what we would hope people would want to learn about.
David?
I think we all need to respect the culture that is being wiped out right now. We participate here in SLO County in some of the activist movements, marches, and what have you. And we feel that it is important to keep the culture alive and not to forget that the Palestinian people, the people of Gaza, also have a history that is now being completely destroyed and wiped out.
Is this a free event?
Yes.
And can you share some more details about it?
Well, we have selected 17 readings from the book, and we put out a call for volunteers to read, and we have 13 community members. Dolores and I may read if we're needed, but 13 community members who are really looking forward to reading these poems.
And they're volunteers?
They're volunteers, mostly people we've met. Some of them are new to me.
And what are the reasons that they're giving for reading this, or is just that they just came and they said, I want to read this poem?
They haven't given reasons explicitly, but I do know that there is a thirst for togetherness around culture and love and peace and civility and a need for some celebration of the heroes of Gaza. And Rafat is one of the greatest heroes now.
Tell us about yourselves and also about your connection with the Palestinian struggle.
I became pro-Palestinian in 1982. So that dates me quite a bit. I was in my early 20s. I am a dancer by profession, and I was getting very interested in Arabic music and dance. It's a very broad dance culture. And through that involvement, I met Palestinian students in Los Angeles. And I hadn't paid too much attention to the conflict in Palestine. But the good thing is I wasn't soaked with propaganda, so I had an open mind. And I spoke for 10 minutes with a Palestinian who became a very good friend of mine. And I realized there was great injustice happening. Later that year, the Sabra and Shatila massacres occurred in Lebanon. Those were refugee camps with mostly Palestinians. So by then I was pretty involved with the Middle Eastern community in Los Angeles, and I was experiencing the feelings of the people here about what was happening to their home. And I got involved in a little bit of activism for about 2 years, and then I went on to do more dance studies, and I thought I'm going to have to focus on my career. But my career, which was in dances of the Middle East and Central Asia and the Islamic world, my career became a message in itself. The medium became the message, and I did hundreds of school shows in Los Angeles focused on the greater Middle East. And I'd sort of forgotten that's just such a part of me, to promote Middle Eastern people and Islamic culture. And that happened over the course of the first Iraq War, over 9/11, all of that. And when we came up here, I was in the process of retiring from the dance company I had in Los Angeles. And then October 7th happened, and we found ourselves in the activist world. And then realized we've always been in this world to one degree or another, but now we're organizers. For about 6 months, we've been organizing. We didn't seek that, but it has sought us.
David?
I believe I've always been interested in justice for people on all levels. As a youth, I was this is kind of scrawny and small, and I was pushed around a lot, and I didn't like that. And as I grew older, then I kind of sympathized with the underdog. What I began to learn about was the injustices around the world. And when we met the Bush family and they got into the White House, and there was a direct draw to the Middle East. And from that point on, I started to really sympathize and become personally involved with research. I wasn't activist outwardly, but researching and trying to find out the causes. As the years have progressed and I was more introduced to Gaza and the problems that were happening there, I became deeply involved with wanting to find answers. And I find that my legislators and the people that I ask questions of have very little knowledge of what they're even talking about, but they're willing to take a hard line because somebody gave them some information and told them what they should think. And I think it's important for us all to read. I believe the word that comes to mind is ikra. Mm-hmm. But we should all read and learn. We can disagree, and we can learn from those that we disagree with mm-hmm. by reading what they have to say and realizing that some of the things they say are not true.
Alarid was killed along with his family members by an Israeli military airstrike on December 6, 2023 in Gaza. Could you share some more about Rifat Alarid's life and work, Carolyn?
Yes. He was raised in Gaza City. When he died, he was only 44 years old when he was, most Palestinians believe, assassinated. He received his BA from the Islamic University of Gaza and his MA from University College London and his PhD in English Literature from the University of Putra in Malaysia. And his dissertation was on John Donne, a very famous English poet, his favorite poet. He taught literature and creative writing at the Islamic University of Gaza. And as you mentioned, he promoted the power of storytelling as resistance against Israeli occupation. This book that we're featuring in our poetry event was posthumously published in December 2024 and includes his last poem, which is If I Should Die, which people the world over are now familiar with.
They are, yeah.
And that became a bestseller, this book. It's a little hard to get now. If you order online, it'll take several weeks because it's in demand. It's been translated into 250 languages.
This poem, If I Must Die, was written by Rifat Alarir. But he had taken that from Claude McKay. And the poem was written in 1919. And I'm not very good at reading, but if you look up, I suppose, If We Must Die by Claude McKay, which was first published in July 1919 in an issue of The Liberator. That was Rifat's inspiration for his poem.
Is this the first ever event that you've organized in Slo County around Palestine? And also, who are the other community members who have worked with you for this and other events?
It's the first event of this type, cultural event, around Palestine. We have been organizing some protests and vigils for the last 6 months. But this is the first cultural event, and we hope the first of many. This is really our background, arts and culture, and we thought we can be of value in this field. The other organizers are Dolores Howard, who is affiliated with various activist organizations, and Hilal Jarar, who is also affiliated with different organizations.
Does this group have a name?
We don't have a name. I've thought of names. Right now, we're just community members. If we need a name, we can use one of our affiliations, which for three of us is the Central Coast Anti-War Coalition.
I think of us as people of conscience, not a title, not a name, but people who are willing to think.
How long has your group been active?
Well, this is our first official collaboration, the four of us, although we've been involved in other actions together. So we've known Dolores since last spring, and Hilal also, because right after October 7th, we started attending protests in Slo that we could find out about. But the group itself, we started organizing this event about 6 weeks ago.
Oh, wow. So this is also quite a new thing. And
yes.
It's great that we're having you here then. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali, talking to Carolyn Kruger and David Yeo about a poetry reading that they have co-organized with other community members in Slo County to honor the Palestinian poet and activist Rifat Alarir. This is a question for both of you. What we have witnessed and continue to witness in Gaza is unprecedented and exceptional in the fact that it is still ongoing. We will never know the exact numbers of people killed in Gaza or the hospitals bombed or schools raided or scholars assassinated. Where does poetry fit in so much suffering, David?
I believe it's the expression of the people, heartfelt expression. It's not the lilting love poems of our European history, but the heartfelt experiences that people are going through today. And if there are those who are not watching it on media and seeing the things that are happening, perhaps they will become educated by reading.
And I follow social media more than my husband does. I hear the constant pleas from Palestinians, do not stop talking about Palestine. Do not stop showing what's happening. Please, your words matter, your deeds matter. And to talk about Palestine through the words of Palestinians, I think is probably the most valuable and the most effective. So we really hope that this event will open some hearts and minds.
Have you faced any challenges or pushback in organizing this event?
No.
No, not this event. Actually, we've had, of course, the first to know have been our activist community. And there's been an outpouring of gratitude and help and support. No pushback.
Curious about the activist community that you both have been talking about. How big is it? How active is it on the Central Coast?
It's larger than you might think, and it is growing daily. I believe that there are the majority of people that see the atrocities and the horrors that are going on are understanding. They're fearful. They won't speak out. I wear my keffiyeh. I wear my scarf. And I expected to have a pushback for it. I have none, had nothing whatsoever. People come up to me and go, thank you. They whisper because they're afraid to be overheard. They say, thank you for wearing that. Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. Thank you for your support, what have you. But I have not had anyone. We do a vigil, and every once in a while, someone will drive by and show us their middle finger. And that's a very educated demonstration of intellect. But I do believe that there are more people that are understanding, along with the rest of the world, but we are well received.
There are several groups on the Central Coast, and actually we've connected now all the way down to Ventura, well, below Ventura, and up into Santa Cruz with like-minded people. There are a lot of Zoom conferences. There are a lot of Signal chat groups. What we don't have is a real centralized pro-Palestinian movement, but you know, maybe some people think that would be ideal, but maybe it's not. All the groups are working, and we're starting to be aware of one another and cooperate more. So I would say the people who are active are in the hundreds. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a head count. I only know by some of the larger protests we've been to, and of course we've got many students involved.
Carolyn, could you read a favorite poem by Refaat Adarir, please, for us?
I will read the shortest poem in his book, also one of the more uplifting poems. It's called Mom. On Ma's face, there is a book and life's preface. Between these lines and in these two caves, life dwells. That line is hope. That one is love. That, death. When she smiles, she gives hope, she gives love, she gives life to life. July 30th, 2012.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, David, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Carolyn Kruger and David Yeo. They are co-organizers, alongside other community members, for a poetry reading that honors the life of Refaat Adarir, Palestinian poet, writer, professor, and activist. The reading happens this Wednesday, February 26th at 7 p.m. at the San Luis Obispo Library Community Room. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.